Hi, everybody. Welcome to Safeguarding in Focus, a podcast brought to you by CPOMS, the market-leading safeguarding software provider. And I'm your host, Sam Eustace. Thank you for joining us again for another exciting episode. Today's episode, we're actually going to be discussing the role of student voice in safeguarding, particularly for children with SEND needs. Looking at exploring how communication, assessment, and relationships kind of come together to build a fuller picture of a child's well-being. And on that journey, helping us explore this topic is our guest Dale Pickles, who's going to be sharing his expertise on understanding how children communicate, the importance of capturing pupil voice effectively, and how schools can balance meaningful safeguarding practice without becoming too overwhelmed by just the data side of things, which I know is a hot topic at the moment. Dale is the director of B Squared. Many of you will have heard of that, that product, that software, that company specializing in assessment solutions for pupils with SEND. And he works closely with schools across the UK to support effective assessment, communication and inclusive practice, helping settings better understand and respond to the needs of learners. It's really exciting to have Dale on, my own experience of using B Squared over the years and meeting the man behind the curtain. So thank you, Dale. Thank you for jumping on here with us.
You are very, very welcome. It always seems strange when people say that because I know I've been doing it for 25 years and we are a small company, but we have had a big impact.
When we first met many months ago and we were discussing all the different things we'd like to do together with CPOMS and my experience as a DSL in special education and working with people with additional needs a lot of my career, it's B Squared has always been a book on the shelf or a logo on the desktop or an element of input that a form's been asking for. And it just seems so synonymous with the work we've been doing, certainly in like Leeds, West Yorkshire area. Yeah, it was exciting to meet you and very surprising, actually, as you say, to find out how small you are and how powerful you are considering that. So
B Squared, there's a team of 13 of us. That's it.
I mean, people have a similar sort of feeling about CPOMS. I mean, we are, you know, considering the size of CPOMS, there's just not that much over 100 people in the organization.
But people think we are a 100-person company.
Yeah, support is two people.
Yeah, and you're like, no, there's not that much money to be made in SEND.
Do you know what? Before we jump into the student voice side of things then, let's just hear a little bit more about your background and what got you into this place of being a, you know, in charge of 13 people and making such a big impact.
So for those who don't know, B Squared was actually started by my mum. She was a teacher. She started the company in 97 after she left teaching. She struggled to show progress in the new national curriculum. So she created something and she was going to use it till something better came along, and that something better never did. And over time we've grown, we've added software. I took over running the company in 2010 and been running it ever since. My previous job before this, I always find entertaining, was I was a forklift truck driver at IKEA, and then basically stepped into help my parents out. But I never just sit still. It's my autism and ADHD. I always look for that better way. I'm always trying to find better ways. I'm always listening and learning. So literally for 25 years, I've just been listening to what schools are struggling with, what they need, what they want to help with, listening to what the government is saying, marrying those two things up and going, okay, how can we achieve this in a way that works for schools? I've been a governor. I was a chair of governor in one school, been a governor in a special school. I also to do youth work. Again, there's often the parents and there's teachers and schools, and it can be a bit of a battleground. And I sit in this weird place of neither, but very invested in the best outcomes for the children.
What an ability from your mum. I mean, incredible woman to just decide, you know what, don't like what's happening, don't like what's available. And to just, I know, without rose tinting it, to just drop on a solution that scaled to like this, you know, is incredible.
So anyone who's used the B Squared paper file, which we did stop a few years ago, but that was what she created in 97.
Still in cupboards.
They've probably asked all those folders in schools and stuff. But that was what she created. And then we turned it into software. So we've had the software now for 26 years. It used to be installed in schools, now web-based, and it's growing and lots more stuff being added in. It's clean and parental communication. But again, it's all come from that initial idea and that initial thing where, well, if no one else is going to do it, I'll do it, until something better comes along. And that bit never did.
And you know what? Those people who are listening, if you've been ingrained in B Squared for some time, like many people are with CPOMS, just it's worth just ringing up someone and just saying, just let me know what I'm missing. Because sometimes people just get so stuck to what you know, you forget about all the, you don't hear about all the magical features that have come in. And in 26 years, I'm sure it's changed.
We had a new version of Connecting Steps out in 2022, I think. And that is a huge change. And people who've used it pre-2022 there is a lot of difference. There's a lot change. It's easier. There's more ways of showing progress for those tiny steps.
So talking progress then, Dale, on that note, given that that's one of the things that we wanted to cover here, there's many different ways to show progress. And that is one of the complexities that you solve. There are also many different ways to express, show, and record student voice, particularly in the context of SEND. To you, what does that really mean in practice then? Particularly for children who may not communicate in traditional ways. You know, I'm sure there's plenty of people here listening who are thinking, well, student voice seems like a very narrow term, or the expectation of what that is might seem quite narrow. What does it mean to you?
If we go back to the main way of demonstrating knowledge in schools, has to be written down. And one of the things I really hoped with the curriculum and assessment review is they were going to maybe have other options, maybe less exams, more coursework, maybe okay. different ways of showing it. I was hoping for anything other than pure writing under pressure. But writing generally exists as a way of sharing information because it is easily accessible by others. So when we think of things like pupil voice, it might be that someone's writing it down, or we expect the children to be able to write down their voice, what they want, what their likes, what their views are. But sometimes that the writing ability is that barrier, in where even when someone is writing down what they say, are they writing it with the same emphasis? Are they missing the sarcasm? Is it written how the child is expressing themselves? So I, for one, having it written down is one thing, but for me, we're in 2026. Why not have that pupil voice as a video or an audio recording so you can listen and watch it again as it was said? To me, that's what we should be doing, is using video more. It's not as easy to access in a meeting, but it's richer.
No, but that's for software companies to solve, isn't it? And people who work with this, not for the people who are capturing that video to solve necessarily. You know, as you say, in its purest form, if you think about like the definition of the word voice, the sound from a vocal cord or whatever, you know, however it would be defined traditionally in a dictionary, that narrows down the scope of what student voice can mean in some people's heads. And, you know, having worked in the SEND field, many kids who can't communicate through that very traditionalist way of through their vocal cords could express so much more on video than what someone's going to be able to write down in a note or in a journal entry or on a system like ours. So yeah, I think it's for us as software companies to make that accessible to people.
That's the thing, because we do have it in Eversense. There is a post type of pupil voice where you could write down, but to me, what you should is that recording. As you said, for those who are pre-verbal, you can video how they react to certain questions and things like that, or kind of what they're pointing to. You can give them options, you can point, but you can capture it.
And that's when you don't lose the inference that you were talking about earlier. So inferring emotions, feelings, thoughts, labeling something with more emotional language than it needed and stuff is all the kind of pitfalls of what can happen.
And miss kind of, you're asking those questions, but again, every time you ask a question, you're kind of guiding, and you can be gatekeeping actually what that child can say, whereas kind of more open and the more things like that, the video is really powerful. But one of the things I like about that video is you can watch it again with the student. You could watch it a year or two later and reflect on those things.
And a professional who's helping with assessments or support has that real-time kind of experience, that experiential learning from that video that they wouldn't otherwise get from a writer. The best will in the world, and this is, it's interesting, isn't it? We talk about risks of safeguarding. You know, if kids can't communicate, if we don't put student voice into things, but actually sometimes we're building inherent risks in when we bring student voice in badly. If we misinterpret it or we don't write it well enough, it's a risk in itself.
Yes, without a doubt. And that kind of that, if someone does have restrictive language or their way of communication requires us to set that method of communication up for them, so anyone who's using picture symbols, things like that, we need to make sure we give them a full vocabulary, not just the positive, happy stuff.
Yeah, not lead the questions, which can be done in any way, shape or form, not just in a verbal interview.
So when we are having people communicating through other means, we need to make sure they have a full vocabulary that they can choose to use. Whether you want them to do it, that's not up to you. You shouldn't be restricting that person's vocabulary.
If you're in a position to be being that aid to anyone in that position, really reflect on what you're doing, the micro movements, feelings, emotions, like your hooks and triggers. What state are you in that moment when you're writing this thing up or you're becoming the interpreter of that moment? Because we know from like high level behavior write-ups and from the old school world of eyewitness testimony and witness recollection and stuff, that your mood, your feeling, your thoughts, they all impact what gets written down in that moment and how you interpret that experience.
And sometimes even your relationship, where you think you know what they mean, and you write down what you think they meant, because actually what you're doing is adding previous things into it rather than just going, actually, this is what they said as is. You're exaggerating it because of previous stuff you know, thinking you're really helping, but actually we want that pure
between the lines.
Yeah.
You're knowing too much almost. Because we always call on the expert of the child, don't we? Of who's that person that knows them the best? But sometimes they know them too well.
There is a whole thing I've seen, a movement like Not My Voice. And it was that when someone's speaking for them, and actually when that person is able to communicate and they have a very different view to that person. Mm-hmm. And that's the one thing, when somebody does have that limited communication, it's even more important to make sure we're giving them a voice and we're listening.
One of the things I was just mulling over there while you were discussing that is that you have to be very sensitive about it. I'm fully aware of that. But even from a training aid perspective, like a video style approach is so useful for supporting people to standardize the way we observe and we write things down and we approach things. I guess you could learn a lot as a group in a school or a setting or an environment who do these observations regularly on how people behave differently to the same video, to the same observational window, just to make sure you've got some consistency around that approach, I guess.
Yeah, because you can. It's all about, it makes me laugh, years ago when my daughter was at nursery, I was at one of these training videos. I think it was done by the DfE or someone, but it was importance of child-led play. They were making monsters and it was all child-led. And then the person who was doing the training, I think it was from DfE, done this video. And it's all put on by the nursery, which was, I thought, was amazing. And it says all child-led. And then she sat there and the child showed her the thing. And then she went, oh, where's the monster's body? And I was like, that's not child-led. Why does a monster need a body? It's the child's imagination. So sometimes don't even know we're doing it. We don't know. But again, how much we actually have an impact on things. And even with that person who's familiar with them, sometimes there's a whole people-pleasing aspect.
There's no malice in it. Just the way we are, doing it to be helpful, doing it to be useful, doing it because you think it's in people's best interests, which is often very useful, but in certain occasions can be detrimental.
And one of the things I think we forget about is student voice is about listening. And one of the conversations I remember having my own children lots is, what do we mean by listening? So if they've done something wrong and I'm telling them what they've done wrong or what they need to do, and it might be they've put something wrong in the dishwasher or something more serious.
Lego in the wrong place.
It's the listening is hearing the words, but then taking an action. So saying sorry is meaningless if you keep doing it. So when we listen, there is hearing those things and writing it down, then we should be taking action. That's the listening part. That's the bit where that child will recognize that you have listened, because they're seeing a result. They're seeing a change. Collecting pupil voice and doing nothing with it and nothing changes is useless.
Collecting it to say you've collected it, is probably the worst thing you can do. Extrapolating beyond just, the verbal and moving into the world of nonverbal, pre-verbal and videos, that is a lot of different parameters that we can work with. And obviously, depending on the complexity you're setting, my goodness, you could have a lot of different styles there. How do we even begin to build that clear picture of children's, I guess, individual communication styles and communication preferences? What's an approach to that we could take? That's a lot.
Joanna Grace, who does lots on sensory communication, she talks about you just have to learn how to listen. And you know that when your child is born and you're literally holding this thing going, what am I supposed to do? They're crying. What are they doing? Why are they crying? And after a while, you learn to recognize that actually, based on the time and things like that, this crying is hunger. Or this is a nappy change, or we learn how to listen. And that's the thing. There isn't no one simple answer. There isn't no this is the thing. But it is about listening at their level and not dismissing again. So once you start listening, you've got to listen and respond to what they're saying. I'm not saying vocally, but what that communication is saying to you. You've got to listen. Now, that could be through eye gaze where they're using, or things where they're typing it out, and that's that communication. It could be using symbols, whatever it is, but that's how we've got to make sure we are listening.
If a school's moving into a world where they're thinking, we want to do a piece of work on this, we want to put a plan together for each pupil around their communication style and preference. Actually, what we're saying here is, don't just rush off and write a plan. Give it a minute. Sit with it. Let it sit in the moment with that child, that young person. Observe, ask questions of other people around them. family, friends, people in the room who work with that young person day to day, and really sit in that moment to see whether your first inference of what that communication style and preference that you were going to write down is actually true.
When we think of pre-verbal or non-verbal complex needs, we don't make assumptions based on what we're seeing. So we don't just kind of go, oh, okay, this is a complex needs child. I don't need to do this. Don't need to do this. They won't be able to. Why are we making that decision so early on? Let's start that conversation at that their level. Let's see how they respond. There's an amazing organization called Teachers Too. It's a charity and it was set up, and I cannot remember his name, but he is an amazing, amazing man who's sadly no longer with us. But I'm literally just on the website. It's Jonathan Bryan is his name. And he had the label PMLD. They tried a couple of things and decided he just couldn't. And so he was offered by school, was very limited. But actually, he couldn't use eye gaze because there was an issue with his eye. They found a way for him to communicate. He ended up going on to university. And he set up this organization called Teachers Too. He's basically saying, stop deciding we can't until you actually find out if we can. When you hear things like that, and you're kind of going, okay, there's four or five complex children. Another person joins is, don't just assume. Start with the assumption they can until you find out they can't. But that is you then working out, okay, how do I listen to you? How are you communicating? What is it I need to do? And as you said, talking to anyone who's met or knows that person and getting that information.
You can do this, even though, you know, the world of academia and aren't always set up for the individuality that it needs to assess that and work with it and roll with it through the school year. You know, we're boxing off people into categories and putting them into different areas and overlaying a schema of how to approach them, deal with them, manage them.
People struggle with the definition of inclusion. And there's lots of people, to me, a lot of the time the definition of inclusion is talking about what we are doing. Yes, we are inclusive because we do this. To me, the inclusive is a really simple definition. Do your students feel included? That's as simple as it goes for me. And if by pupil voice, you are listening and you are taking action, and again, not all actions, if they want to have a swimming pool in their classroom, that's obviously not going to happen.
Yeah, inclusion doesn't mean give them everything that a kid asks for.
Having that conversation and maybe going, you know what, it's a summer's day, in the summertime, we'll stick a paddling pool in the classroom for a Friday afternoon. And if you do that 6 months after they asked it, that's going to be a remembered that you listened.
But you know, that's right. Like you asked that question, but then a very simple definition of inclusion. I'd go one step onto that and say it's do your children, young people, students, service users, wherever they may be, feel included? Do you know how you know that? You can say yes, but prove it. And the student voice element is the proof in the pudding.
It's them asking, you listening, you then, where you can take action, use what that information you know, and you build that relationship. That is going to give them that sense of belonging. That will make them feel included. And to me, that's why pupil voice is so important. It isn't a tick box exercise you do as part of an EHCP process. Yep. This is something we do throughout. It's not a tokenistic, we've got a student council to make them feel. So if you are having that, that's got to be, and it's a listening thing, but where they are asking for random things which can't happen is go, yeah, that, and it goes through, explain why, and it then helps them adjust what they do ask for.
Shouldn't be tokenistic. See through stuff like tokenistic gestures are the kids in the schools. They don't buy into it after a small period of time. It's because they feel like it's a tokenistic.
And that's a moment, that's when a school stops being inclusive. When you're doing the pupil voice, they're saying, oh, you're writing it, you're sticking it on a share, going, we collected pupil voice, and nothing's happening.
Into action, not just a commitment to write stuff down, isn't it? And one of the other stakeholders in that, you know, pupil voice super important, but one of the other stakeholders definitely parents and carers. Another often forgotten about area of frustration for some, you know,
yes,
absolutely. But an area that can pose a challenge, yes, definitely. You know, let's not shy away from the fact that that can be a hard part of working in a setting, but are a key part of safeguarding and attaining student voice and understanding how to work with and support pupils. So, you must have come across some fairly common challenges in schools.
So in Eversense, which is our kind of evidence and parental communication system, and it started off as evidence, we said, oh yeah, you don't have to start with parental access, but if you kind of, as you get used the system, you can allow them to have access and they can like, then the next level you can then allow them to comment, and if we always use a phrase, if you're really brave, you can allow them to add their own posts. There is this fear of giving parents a way to communicate with schools makes people worried. I do find it odd because that fear shouldn't come from nowhere, but to me the fear is there because they already know that the school and the parents aren't always aligned.
Yeah, it's an interesting thought, actually. Yeah, because my first thought went through like, oh, you know, apprehensions I've heard in the past of workload, communication at different times, out of hours, balancing communication with parents versus teaching the kids, all that other stuff that generally crops up, and isolating communication with certain parents or certain teachers and putting them in a vulnerable position. But actually, good point, Dale. Sometimes you just don't want to do it because you know it's not going to be good for you, because you're not getting it right at the minute.
So if you do give parents another way to communicate, what are they going to say? And so sometimes it is purely, it's not you are, you know it's going to be bad, but you just don't know. What's worse than asking, well, actually, I think asking someone and not listening is worse, but actually not even asking them and not making them feel part of it is also extremely bad. And over the last few years, we've seen lots of reports talking about the importance of school and parental communication and needs to be more. I do worry that when people see more communication, they're thinking more messages from school.
Send a load of letters.
To me, what I think the government is really asking for is two-way communication. Don't broadcast stuff.
When we're making complex plans around complex pupils, are we getting their involvement and input? And are we seeing the evidence gathering day-to-day between those plan reviews that could come through software or through engagement?
There are things, you're obviously, with that EHCP, you're working towards something. And the children do not spend the majority of their life in school, 39 weeks a year, 8 hours a day type thing and stuff. They've got all this other time at home. And surely that makes the parents a partner in you achieving those outcomes. And there's no point in meeting once a year, twice a year to discuss it. To me, that should be an ongoing thing. And I also think that a lot of the time for parents, the reason, especially for special needs parents who don't always have that trust in the school. And again, if you're a school, if you're a teacher listening to this, think of one of the students, think of all the communication that's happened this term, work out how much of it's been positive, how much has it been negative because of detentions, not doing this, external exclusion, all that sort of stuff, and how much it was broadcasting, just like school newsletters. And what you'll end up with is everyone's get this broadcasting stuff. Everyone's where there are challenges, get the negative. Where is there any positive? And I'm not saying over the top. I'm not a fan of sticker charts. But if you are going to point out the negative, you should be pointing out some positives.
Transactional theory, isn't it? Yeah,
if you can have some positive comments throughout a term and then a negative thing happens, that's one negative thing against six or seven positive things. But if you're only getting negative because the school doesn't understand, and that's, again, it's not that they do or do not understand, but if your only communication is negative, you're going to perceive that the school doesn't understand. So I think that more individualized, low-key, not big emails, but yep, social media type thing, that, you know, just how's it going? He didn't have a great day today. Mm-hmm. Not a big, oh, there's an email from the school and it's quite formal. Just a soft touch message.
There's a lot of benefit to just, I know many schools do it where they send key figures, leaders, central people from teams around children onto like front gates, car parks, pickup points, you know, being visible in those areas to have the even lower key conversations than that, like stroking the dog or saying hello to the siblings or asking them how their weekend was. And those little things that are nothing to do with the day to day pay dividends. You know, we spoke about it a lot in schools about it being like the bank account. You know, every parent has that bank account and you can either deposit money or you can take it out. If you take out too much and go overdrawn, then when you need a difficult conversation, you're already not in a good place with the bank. Whereas actually, if you can keep it topped up and stay in the green, you can afford the odd big withdrawal, and the overarching feeling is still, hey, they're doing it from the right place.
And that thing, if you're recognizing those positive bits, yeah, if you know that that is a challenge for that person and they're doing it, just recognize it. Small message home or mentioning it. When there is the issue, as you said, I like that analogy, there is money in the bank. They're already having a good relationship with you. They have lots of positive. They know it's a blip. It makes the communication so much better.
And the systems out there, isn't there, that are doing, you know, you've mentioned yours, that are doing stuff to support parental engagement, make it a bit easier. It can seem super easy to record stuff, and therefore, are people as discerning with what they record? Is there a risk of over-recording or over-analyzing every micro piece of the puzzle? There's a lot more info now than there used to be kind of 25 years ago available to someone working with a child or a family. Can it ever be too much?
It depends. To me, you can have lots of pieces of a puzzle, but what you shouldn't do is jump to conclusions, because we all have bad days. We all have great days. but it is piecing those things together. The more information you've got, the better picture you'll have. And also when we talk about, again, with a new white paper, we're very much moving to a needs-based rather than diagnosis-based. The Ofsted Inspection Framework talks about disadvantaged students, including those with SEND. So it's recognised there's actually, there's lots of children. Child Commissioner's report talked about the home life, that actually that home life can have a huge impact on them in school, and how much do schools know about that. So to me, you want more data, but we shouldn't then judge or jump to conclusions with that.
And we don't want people to miss important, relevant and high level kind of concern data and issues that indicate safety problems or anything like that in there, I guess. It's not my own question. I feel like that's for us to solve.
You don't go from nothing to high straight away.
And we shouldn't be building systems that hide that stuff. You know, our systems as we build them should allow you to record but still see the insights. They'll get the relevant stuff.
But that's the thing, is when we, again, going back to that pupil voice and going back to learning how to listen, as you said, the best people to find it out from are the parents. The best people to kind of keep you in touch of what's changing, how they're doing at school. They might have a great day at school or appear to have a great day at school, but if they then get home and they're exploding because they've been masking all day, then they didn't have a great day at school. But the parents are going to be the best way of finding out, well, what is going on? So you need that relationship. So for pupil voice to work, you need to have parent voice.
Context is so key. And I think from my perspective, as from the safeguarding side of things, I think contextual safeguarding to me has been one of the most important things to come out of safeguarding for a long time. The lines of inquiry that having context opens up with a parent, a carer, family members, in anything, safeguarding, attainment, assessments for EHCPs, whatever. If you build enough data, you have more lines of inquiry to open up an open and honest conversation than to be dismissed straight away, because you're not coming with a proper inquiry. You're coming with an open, is anything... what's going on? How's it been at home? Like, you know, I'm a social butterfly, Dale. But if someone asks me, how are you? I'm from Yorkshire, so I'm going to say I'm all right. And I might not be. But if someone...
You'll always say I'm all right.
Exactly. But if someone specifically says to me, a couple of days ago, I saw you crying in the corridor, are you all right? I'm probably going to talk a little bit more about those feelings, thinking that they're coming from a genuine place. So context is mega powerful.
And you mentioned attainment there, and that's the thing. There's lots of numbers we can line up together, all kind of show a big picture. And one of the things that I've always hated is that term below. Hate it, hate it, hate it, hate it. If all you know about your child in your class is they're working below, basically means you don't care. That's what whenever I see it, it's literally like, you're not important enough to us to actually know exactly where you are. That's the parent, the message is getting, the parents are getting as well. That's what they're hearing. That's what they're already feeling about you and their child. So again, it is about building those relationships and that parent knowing their child is making progress. That's what they want. It might not be giant. They already know their child's not making the same progress as their peers in that class. They know that already. But they still want to know there is progress happening, that actually them going to school, there's an outcome. They're moving forward. That's a big part, again, of this whole picture, is what is building that relationship is actually, are you doing anything for my child? What are we doing? What all of that comes together to build that relationship.
A whole child approach to kind of conversing with them. So as a final kind of wrap up, school leaders, practitioners, people from all walks of life listening to us today, hopefully, do you have any practical steps that they can take away to strengthen student voice within that?
Saying the first practical step is going to be, do you have it? Do you have it recorded anywhere? And if, because a lot of times we do collect it, but if you're collecting it for kind of as part of a process, are you doing anything with it? So if you have collected it, go find where it's recorded, read through it, and then ask yourselves, have we done any of this?
Bit of an audit on whether you've actioned any of the student voice or whether you've changed practice based on some student voice.
Every school is in a different place. Some schools collect it. Some schools collect it because they have to. But the first thing you should be doing to really make it work is, are we doing anything with this? That's the first practical thing. Anything else I suggest, if you're not doing anything, there's no point in me even saying anything.
Ask around, I guess. Ask a couple of people in your leadership teams. See what they think you're doing for student voices, etc. If everyone doesn't come up with a coherent answer that makes sense across the board, then it might need to be a topic of a discussion at some point too.
And I'm going to say the word uniform. That's a big issue for me in school. If everyone is against the uniform or whatever, or some part of that uniform policy, why not change it? And that's the thing, the moment you do respond to something, and if it's some part of the uniform policy, let's say I've got two girls and you weren't allowed to wear shorts for PE. If you're a girl, you've got some rule like that and everyone says they should be allowed to wear shorts. Why not? What's that impact? If you allow the girls to wear shorts, what's the impact? You are someone who listens. You are, to me, the only impact of you doing that is positive. To me, that's a big thing, is listening and changing. And I know there's a lot of contention around uniforms in various places. I don't miss the obvious ones. I go straight for them. But you've got to ask yourself, why? And if you can't think of a real reason apart from because, or it's the way it's always been, you've really got to reflect on what is the real impact. Because if we did this, this is really going to build that relationship with our students. It's going to be a positive outcome. And that's the thing, is you've got to sit there and going, if all the people are doing this, saying this, we need to listen.
And all that extrapolates to, you know, the theme of safeguarding. If you, not that I'd suggest that we have a huge safeguarding issue with shorts in PE, but really evaluating where you are with capturing student voice in systems, in processes, in safeguarding, it really should be at the heart of everything that you're doing. And if it is, have you got obvious evidence that you've adjusted your approach, your intervention, or the outcome of that concern based on that voice, or that you've used it as a crucial part to really inform the decisions that you make? Or have you just ticked off student voice is in this concern, therefore we've done our bit? I think today's podcast is going to really invite some interesting discussions across teams. I think people get complacent sometimes with, you know, there's a category for it in CPOMS, therefore we've got it, or we use B squared and every so often we get to put a little bit of a quote on or whatever. Like, it's token gestures versus is it a reality of your day-to-day practice. It'd be an interesting conversation for many to have. I'm gonna have to wrap it up though, Dale, because of our time, unfortunately.
That's fine.
Thank you so much for joining us today. To anyone who's made it through this far listening and has done a couple of other episodes with me running this one, thank you so much for tuning in again to Safeguarding in Focus. Make sure you subscribe to our podcast on your preferred podcast platform so you don't miss out on future very engaging and insightful discussions, and we'll see you on the next one. Thank you.